Congratulations. And Claire embraces Sharon, who looks at me over Claire's shoulder, startled but smiling. Later, Sharon tells me, I think you've got the only nice one. I shake my head, but I know what she means.
There's an hour before dinner, and no one will notice if we're gone. Come on, I tell Henry. Let's go outside. He groans. Must we? I want to show you something. We put on our coats and boots and hats and gloves and tromp through the house and out the back door. The sky is clear, ultramarine blue, and the snow over the meadow reflects it back lighter, and the two blues meet in the dark line of trees that is the beginning of the woods. It's too early for stars, but there's an airplane blinking its way across space. I imagine our house as a tiny dot of light seen from the plane like a star. This way. The path to the clearing is under 6 inches of snow. I think of all the times I have stomped over bare footprints so no one would see them running down the path toward the house. Now there are deer tracks and the prints of a large dog, the stubble of dead plants under snow, wind, the sound of our boots. The clearing is a smooth bowl of blue snow. The rock is an island with a mushroom top. This is it. Henry stands with his hands in his coat pockets. He swivels around, looking. So this is it, he says. I search his face for a trace of recognition. Nothing. Do you ever have déjà vu? I ask him. Henry sighs. My whole life is one long déjà vu. We turn and walk over our own tracks, back to the house. Later. I have warned Henry that we dress for dinner on Christmas Eve, and so when I meet him in the hall, he is resplendent in a black suit, white shirt, maroon tie, with a mother-of-pearl tie clasp. Goodness, I say, you've shined your shoes.
I have, he admits. Pathetic, isn't it?
You look perfect. A nice young man.
When in fact I am the punk librarian deluxe. Parents, beware.
They'll adore you.
I adore you. Come here.
Henry and I stand before the full-length mirror at the top of the stairs, admiring ourselves. I am wearing a pale green silk strapless dress, which belonged to my grandmother. I have a photograph of her wearing it on New Year's Eve, 1941. She's laughing. Her lips are dark with lipstick, and she's holding a cigarette. The man in the photograph is her brother Teddy, who was killed in France 6 months later. He's laughing, too. Henry puts his hands on my waist and expresses surprise at all the boning and corsetry under the silk. I tell him about Grandma. She was smaller than me. It only hurts when I sit down. The ends of the steel thingies poke into my hips. Henry is kissing my neck when someone coughs and we spring apart. Mark and Sharon stand in the door of Mark's room, which Mama and Daddy have reluctantly agreed there is no point in their not sharing.
None of that now,
Mark says in his annoyed schoolmarm voice.
Haven't you learned anything from the painful example of your elders, boys and girls?
Yes, replies Henry. Be prepared.
He pats his pants pocket, which is actually empty, with a smile, and we sail down the stairs as Sharon giggles. Everyone's already had a few drinks when we arrive in the living room. Alicia makes our private hand signal. Watch out for Mama, she's messed up. Mama is sitting on the couch, looking harmless, her hair all piled up into a chignon, wearing her pearls and her peach velvet dress with the lace sleeves. She looks pleased when Mark goes over and sits down next to her. Laughs when he makes some little joke for her, and I wonder for a moment if Alicia's mistaken. But then I see how Daddy is watching Mama, and I realize that she must have said something awful just before we came in. Daddy is standing by the drinks cart, and he turns to me, relieved, and pours me a Coke and hands Mark a beer and a glass. He asks Sharon and Henry what they'll have. Sharon asks for La Croix. Henry, after pondering for a moment, asks for scotch and water. My father mixes drinks with a heavy hand, and his eyes bug out a little when Henry knocks back the scotch effortlessly.
Another? No, thank you.
I know by now that Henry would like to simply take the bottle and a glass and curl up in bed with a book, and that he is refusing seconds because he would then feel no compunction about thirds and fourths. Sharon hovers at Henry's elbow, and I abandon them, crossing the room to sit by Aunt Dulcie in the window seat.
Oh, child, how lovely! I haven't seen that dress since Elizabeth wore it to the party the Licks had at the planetarium.
Alicia joins us. She is wearing a navy blue turtleneck with a tiny hole where the sleeve is separating from the bodice, and an old bedraggled kilt with wool stockings that bag around her ankles like an old lady's. I know she's doing it to bug Daddy, but still.
What's wrong with Mama?
I ask her. Alicia shrugs. She's pissed off about Sharon.
What's wrong with Sharon? Inquires Dulcie, reading our lips. She seems very nice. Nicer than Mark, if you ask me.
She's pregnant, I tell Dulcie. They're getting married. Mama thinks she's white trash because she's the first person in her family to go to college.
Dulcie looks at me sharply and sees that I know what she knows. Lucille, of all people, ought to be a little understanding of that young girl.
Alicia is about to ask Dulcie what she means when the dinner bell rings, and we rise, Pavlovian, and file toward the dining room. I whisper to Alicia, "Is she drunk?" And Alicia whispers back, "I think she was drinking in her room before dinner." I squeeze Alicia's hand, and Henry hangs back, and we go into the dining room and find our places, Daddy and Mama at the head and foot of the table, Dulcie and Sharon and Mark on one side, with Mark next to Mama, and Alicia and Henry and me, with Alicia next to Daddy. The room is full of candles and little flowers floating in cut glass bowls, and Etta has laid out all the silver and china on Grandma's embroidered tablecloth from the nuns in Provence. In short, it is Christmas Eve. Exactly like every Christmas Eve I can remember, except that Henry is at my side, sheepishly bowing his head as my father says grace.
Heavenly Father, we give thanks on this holy night for your mercy and for your benevolence, for another year of health and happiness, for the comfort of family, and for new friends. We thank you for sending your Son to guide us and redeem us in the form of a helpless infant, and we thank you for the baby Mark and Sharon will be bringing into our family. We beg to be more perfect in our love and patience with each other. Amen.
Uh-oh, I think. Now he's done it. I dart a glance at Mama, and she is seething. You would never know it if you didn't know Mama. She's very still, and she stares at her plate. The kitchen door opens, and Etta comes in with the soup and sets a small bowl in front of each of us. I catch Mark's eye, and he inclines his head slightly toward Mama and raises his eyebrows, and I just nod a tiny nod. He asks her a question about this year's apple harvest, and she answers. Alicia and I relax a little bit. Sharon is watching me, and I wink at her. The soup is chestnut and parsnip, which seems like a bad idea until you taste Nell's. "Wow," Henry says, and we all laugh and eat up our soup. Etta clears away the soup bowls, and Nell brings in the turkey. It is golden and steaming and huge, and we all applaud enthusiastically, as we do every year. Nell beams and says, "Well, now," as she does every year.
"Oh, Nell, it's perfect," my mother says with tears in her eyes.
Nell looks at her sharply and then at Daddy and says,
"Thank you, Miss Lucille."
Etta serves us stuffing, glazed carrots, mashed potatoes, and lemon curd, and we pass our plates to Daddy, who heaps them with turkey. I watch Henry as he takes his first bite of Nell's turkey. Surprise, then bliss.
"I have seen my future," he announces, and I stiffen. "I am going to give up librarianing and come and live in your kitchen and worship at Nell's feet. Or perhaps I will just marry her." "You're too late," says Mark. "Nell is already married." "Oh, well, it will have to be her feet then. Why don't all of you weigh 300 pounds?
"I'm working on it," my father says, patting his paunch.
"I'm going to weigh 300 pounds when I'm old and I don't have to drag my cello around anymore," Alicia tells Henry. "I'm going to live in Paris and eat nothing but chocolate, and I'm going to smoke cigars and shoot heroin and listen to nothing but Jimi Hendrix and the Doors. Right, Mama?"
"I'll join you," Mama says grandly, "but I would rather listen to Johnny Mathis." "If you shoot heroin, you won't want to eat much of anything.
Henry informs Alicia, who regards him speculatively.
Try marijuana instead.
Daddy frowns. Mark changes the subject.
I heard on the radio that it's supposed to snow 8 inches tonight.
8, we chorus. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas,
Sharon ventures without conviction. I hope it doesn't all dump on us while we're in church, Alicia says grumpily. I get so sleepy after Mass. We chatter on about snowstorms we have known. Dulcie tells about being caught in the big blizzard of 1967 in Chicago.
I had to leave my car on Lakeshore Drive and walk all the way from Adams to Belmont. I got stuck in that one, says Henry. I almost froze. I ended up in the rectory of the Fourth Presbyterian Church on Michigan Avenue. How old were you?
Asks Daddy, and Henry hesitates and replies,
3.
He glances at me, and I realize he's talking about an experience he had while time-traveling, and he adds,
I was with my father.
It seems transparently obvious to me that he's lying, but no one seems to notice. Etta comes in and clears our dishes and sets out dessert plates. After a slight delay, Nell comes in with the flaming plum pudding.
Oompa, says Henry.
She sets the pudding down in front of Mama, and the flames turn Mama's pale hair copper red, like mine, for a moment before they die out. Daddy opens the champagne, under a dish towel so the cork won't put out anybody's eyeball. We all pass our glasses to him, and he fills them and we pass them back. Mama cuts thin slices of plum pudding, and Etta serves everyone. There are 2 extra glasses, one for Etta and one for Nell, and we all stand up for the toasts. My father begins,
to family.
To Nell and Etta, who are like family, who work so hard and make our home and have so many talents, my mother says, breathless and soft.
To peace and justice, says Dulcie.
To family, says Etta.
To beginnings, says Mark, toasting Sharon.
To chance, she replies. It's my turn. I look at Henry. To happiness. To here and now.
Henry gravely replies, to world enough and time.
And my heart skips, and I wonder how he knows.
But then I realize that Marvel's one of his favorite poets, and he's not referring to anything but the future.
To snow, and Jesus, and Mama, and Daddy, and Catgut, and Sugar, and my new red Converse high tops, says Alicia, and we all laugh.
To love,
says Nell, looking right at me, smiling her vast smile.
And to Morton Thompson, inventor of the best-eaten turkey on the planet Earth.
All through dinner, Lucille has been careening wildly from sadness to elation to despair. Her entire family has been carefully navigating her mood, driving her into neutral territory again and again, buffering her, protecting her. But as we sit down and begin to eat dessert, she breaks down and sobs silently, her shoulders shaking, her head turned away as though she's going to tuck it under her wing like a sleeping bird. At first, I am the only person who notices this, and I sit horrified, unsure what to do. Then Philip sees her, and then the whole table falls quiet. He's on his feet by her side.
Lucy, he whispers. Lucy, what is it?
Claire hurries to her, saying,
come on, Mama. It's okay. Mama.
Lucille is shaking her head.
No, no, no.
And wringing her hands. Philip backs off. Claire says,
hush,
and Lucille is speaking urgently but not very clearly. I hear a rush of unintelligibleness, then,
all wrong,
and then,
ruin his chances,
and finally,
I am just utterly disregarded in this family,
and
hypocritical,
and then sobs. To my surprise, it's great-aunt Dulcie who breaks the stunned stillness.
Child, if anybody's a hypocrite here, it's you. You did the exact same thing, and I don't see that it ruined Philip's chances one bit. Improved them, if you ask me.
Lucille stops crying and looks at her aunt, shocked into silence. Mark looks at his father, who nods once, and then at Sharon, who is smiling as though she's won at bingo. I look at Claire, who doesn't seem particularly astonished, and I wonder how she knew if Mark didn't. And I wonder what else she knows that she hasn't mentioned. And then it is borne in on me that Claire knows everything, our future, our past, everything. And I shiver in the warm room. Etta brings coffee. We don't linger over it.
Etta and I have put Mama to bed. She kept apologizing the way she always does and trying to convince us that she was well enough to go to Mass. But we finally got her to lie down, and almost immediately she was asleep. Etta says that she will stay home in case Mama wakes up, and I tell her not to be silly, I'll stay. But Etta is obstinate, and so I leave her sitting by the bed, reading St. Matthew. I walk down the hall and peek into Henry's room, but it's dark. When I open my door, I find Henry, supine on my bed, reading A Wrinkle in Time. I lock the door and join him on the bed. "What's wrong with your mom?" he asks as I carefully arrange myself next to him, trying not to get stabbed by my dress. "She's manic depressive."
"Has she always been?"
"She was better when I was little. She had a baby that died when I was 7, and that was bad. She tried to kill herself. I found her. I remember the blood everywhere. The bathtub full of bloody water. The towel soaked with it. Screaming for help and nobody was home. Henry doesn't say anything, and I crane my neck and he is staring at the ceiling.
"Claire," he finally says.
"What?"
"How come you didn't tell me? I mean, there's kind of a lot of stuff going on with your family that it would have been good to know ahead of time."
"But you knew..." I trail off. "He didn't know. How could he know?" "I'm sorry. It's just... I told you when it happened, and I forget that now is before then, and so I think you know all about it." Henry pauses and then says,
"Well, I've sort of emptied the bag as far as my family is concerned. All the closets and skeletons have been displayed for your inspection, and I was just surprised. I don't know."
"But you haven't introduced me to him. I'm dying to meet Henry's dad, but I've been afraid to bring it up."
"No, I haven't."
"Are you going to?"
"Eventually."
"When?" "I expect Henry to tell me I'm pushing my luck like he always used to when I asked too many questions. But instead he sits up and swings his legs off the side of the bed. The back of his shirt is all wrinkled.
I don't know, Claire. When I can stand it, I guess."
I hear footsteps outside the door that stop, and the doorknob jiggles back and forth.
"Claire," my father says, "why is the door locked?"
I get up and open the door. Daddy opens his mouth and then sees Henry and beckons me into the hall.
"Claire, you know your mother and I don't approve of you inviting your friend into your bedroom,"
he says quietly. "There are plenty of rooms in this house." "We were just talking."
"You can talk in the living room."
"I was telling him about Mama, and I didn't want to talk about it in the living room, okay?"
"Honey, I really don't think it's necessary to tell him about your mother."
"After the performance she just gave, what am I supposed to do? Henry can see for himself that she's wacko. He isn't stupid." My voice is rising, and Alicia opens her door and puts her finger to her lips.
"Your mother is not wacko," my father says sternly.
"Yes, she is," Alicia affirms, joining the fray.
"You stay out of this."
"The hell I will."
"Alicia!"
Daddy's face is dark red and his eyes are protruding and his voice is very loud. Etta opens Mama's door and looks at the three of us with exasperation. "Go downstairs if you want to yell," she hisses and closes the door. We look at each other, abashed. "Later," I tell Daddy. "Give me a hard time later." Henry has been sitting on my bed this whole time, trying to pretend he's not here. "Come on, Henry. Let's go sit in some other room." Henry, docile as a small, rebuked boy, stands and follows me downstairs.
Alicia glumps after us.
At the bottom of the stairs, I look up and see Daddy looking down at us helplessly. He turns and walks over to Mama's door and knocks. "Hey, let's watch It's a Wonderful Life," Alicia says, looking at her watch. "It's on Channel 60 in 5 minutes."
"Again? Haven't you seen it like 200 times already?"
Alicia has a thing for Jimmy Stewart.
I've never seen it, says Henry. Alicia affects shock.
Never? How come?
I don't have a television. Now Alicia really is shocked.
Did yours break or something?
Henry laughs. No, I just hate them. They give me headaches. They make him time travel. It's the flickering quality of the picture. Alicia is disappointed.
So you don't want to watch?
Henry glances at me. I don't mind.
Sure,
I say. For a while. We won't see the end, though. We have to get ready for Mass. We troop into the TV room, which is off the living room. Alicia turns on the set. A choir is singing "It Came Upon the Midnight Clear."
Ugh, she sneers. Look at those bad yellow plastic robes. They look like rain ponchos.
She plops down on the floor and Henry sits on the couch. I sit down next to him. Ever since we arrived, I have been worrying constantly about how to behave in front of my various family members in terms of Henry. How close should I sit? If Alicia weren't here, I would lie down on the couch, put my head on Henry's lap. Henry solves my problem by scooting closer and putting his arm around me. It's kind of a self-conscious arm. We would never sit this way in any other context. Of course, we never watch TV together. Maybe this is how we would sit if we ever watched TV. The choir disappears and a slew of commercials comes on. McDonald's, a local Buick dealership, Pillsbury, Red Lobster, they all wish us a Merry Christmas. I look at Henry, who has an expression of blank amazement on his face.
What?
I ask him softly.
The speed. They jump cut every couple seconds. I'm going to be ill.
Henry rubs his eyes with his fingers. I think I'll just go read for a while. He gets up and walks out of the room, and in a minute I hear his feet on the stairs. I offer up a quick prayer. Please, God, let Henry not time travel, especially not when we're about to go to church and I won't be able to explain. Alicia scrambles onto the couch as the opening credits appear on the screen. He didn't last long, she observes. He gets these really bad headaches, the kind where you have to lie in the dark and not move, and if anybody says boo, your brain explodes.
Oh.
James Stewart is flashing a bunch of travel brochures, but his departure is cut short by the necessity of attending a dance. He's really cute.
Jimmy Stewart?
Him too. I meant your guy, Henry. I grin. I am as proud as if I had made Henry myself.
Yeah.
Donna Reed is smiling radiantly at Jimmy Stewart across a crowded room. Now they are dancing, and Jimmy Stewart's rival has turned the switch that causes the dance floor to open over a swimming pool. Mama really likes him.
Hallelujah!
Donna and Jimmy dance backwards into the pool. Soon people in evening clothes are diving in after them as the band continues playing. Nell and Etta approve also.
Great. Now we just have to get through the next 36 hours without ruining the good first impression.
How hard can that be?
Unless... No. You wouldn't be that dumb.
Alicia looks over at me dubiously.
Would you?
Of course not, she echoes.
God, I can't believe Mark. What a stupid fuck.
Jimmy and Donna are singing Buffalo Girls, Won't You Come Out Tonight, while walking down the streets of Bedford Falls, resplendent in football uniform and bathrobe, respectively.
You should have been here yesterday. I thought Daddy was going to have a coronary right in front of the Christmas tree. I was imagining him crashing into it and the tree falling on him and the paramedics having to heave all the ornaments and presents off him before they could do CPR.
Jimmy offers Donna the moon and Donna accepts.
I thought you learned CPR in school.
I would be too busy trying to revive Mama. It was bad, Claire. There was a lot of yelling.
Was Sharon there?
Alicia laughs grimly.
Are you kidding? Sharon and I were in here trying to chat politely, you know, and Mark and the parentals were in the living room screaming at each other. After a while, we just sat here and listened.
Alicia and I exchange a look that just means, so what else is new? We have spent our lives listening to our parents yelling at each other, at us. Sometimes I feel like if I have to watch Mama cry one more time, I'm going to leave forever and never come back. Right now, I want to grab Henry and drive back to Chicago where no one can yell, no one can pretend everything is okay and nothing happened. An irate, paunchy man in an undershirt yells at James Stewart to stop talking Donna Reed to death and just kiss her. I couldn't agree more, but he doesn't.
Instead, he steps on her robe, and she walks obliviously out of it. And the next thing you know, she's hiding naked in a large hydrangea bush. A commercial for Pizza Hut comes on, and Alicia turns off the sound. Claire?
Yeah?
Has Henry ever been here before?
Uh-oh.
No, I don't think so. Why?
She shifts uneasily and looks away for a second.
You're gonna think I'm nuts.
What?
See, I had this weird thing happen. A long time ago, I was like about 12, and I was supposed to be practicing. But then I remembered that I didn't have a clean shirt for this audition or something, and Etta and everybody were out someplace, and Mark was supposed to be babysitting, but he was in his room doing bongs or whatever. Anyway, so I went downstairs to the laundry room, and I was looking for my shirt, and I heard this noise, you know, like the door at the south end of the basement, the one that goes into the room with all the bicycles, that sort of whoosh noise. So I thought it was Peter, right? So I was standing in the door of the laundry room, sort of listening, and the door to the bicycle room opens, and, Claire, you won't believe this, it was this totally naked guy who looked just like Henry.
When I start laughing, it sounds fake.
Oh, come on!
Alicia grins. See, I knew you would think it was nuts, but I swear it really happened. So this guy just looks a little surprised, you know? I mean, I'm standing there with my mouth hanging open and wondering if this naked guy is going to, you know, rape me or kill me or something, and he just looks at me and goes, "Oh, hi, Alicia," and walks into the reading room and shuts the door.
Huh?
So I run upstairs, and I'm banging on Mark's door, and he's telling me to buzz off, and so finally I get him to open the door, and he's so stoned that it takes a while before he gets what I'm talking about. And then, of course, he doesn't believe me. But finally I get him to come downstairs, and he knocks on the reading room door, and we are both really scared. It's like Nancy Drew, you know, where you're thinking, those girls are really dumb, they should just call the police. But nothing happens. And then Mark opens the door, and there's nobody there. And he is mad at me for, like, making it up. But then we think the man went upstairs, so we both go and sit in the kitchen next to the phone with Nell's big carving knife on the counter.
How come you never told me about this?
Well, by the time you all got home, I felt kind of stupid, and I knew that Daddy especially would think it was a big deal and nothing really happened. But it wasn't funny either, and I didn't feel like talking about it.
Alicia laughs. I asked Grandma once if there were any ghosts in the house, but she said there weren't any she knew of.
And this guy, or ghost, looked like Henry?
Yeah. I swear, Claire, I almost died when you guys came in and I saw him. I mean, he's the guy. Even his voice is the same.
Well, the one I saw in the basement had shorter hair, and he was older, maybe around 40.
But if that guy was 40, and it was 5 years ago, Henry is only 28, so he would have been 23 then, Alicia.
Oh, huh.
But, Claire, it's too weird. Does he have a brother?
No. His dad doesn't look much like him.
Maybe it was, you know, astral projection or something.
Time travel, I offer, smiling.
Oh, yeah, right. God, how bizarre.
The TV screen is dark for a moment. Then we are back with Donna in her hydrangea bush and Jimmy Stewart walking around it with her bathrobe draped over one arm. He's teasing her, telling her he's going to sell tickets to see her. The cad, I think, even as I blush, remembering worse things I've said and done to Henry vis-a-vis the issue of clothing and nakedness. But then a car rolls up and Jimmy Stewart throws Donna her bathrobe.
"Your father's had a stroke,"
says someone in the car, and off he goes with hardly a backward glance as Donna Reed stands bereft in her foliage. My eyes tear up.
"Geez, Claire, it's okay. He'll be back,"
Alicia reminds me. I smile, and we settle in to watch Mr. Potter taunting poor Jimmy Stewart into giving up college and running a doomed savings and loan.
"Bastard,"
Alicia says.
"Bastard." I agree.
As we walk out of the cold night air into the warmth and light of the church, my guts are churning. I've never been to a Catholic mass. The last time I attended any sort of religious service was my mom's funeral. I'm holding on to Claire's arm like a blind man as she leads us up the central aisle and we file into an empty pew. Claire and her family kneel on the cushioned kneelers, and I sit as Claire has told me to. We are early. Alicia has disappeared, and Nell is sitting behind us with her husband and their son, who's on leave from the Navy. Dulcie sits with a contemporary of hers. Claire, Mark, Sharon, and Philip kneel side by side in varying attitudes. Claire is self-conscious, Mark perfunctory, Sharon calm and absorbed, Philip exhausted. The church is full of poinsettias. It smells like wax and wet coats. There's an elaborate stable scene with Mary and Joseph and their entourage to the right of the altar. People are filing in, choosing seats, greeting each other. Claire slides onto the seat next to me, and Mark and Philip follow suit. Sharon remains on her knees for a few more minutes, and then we are all sitting quietly in a row, waiting. A man in a suit walks onto the stage, altar, whatever, and tests the microphones that are attached to the little reading stands, then disappears into the back again. There are many more people now. It's crowded. Alicia and two other women and a man appear stage left, carrying their instruments. The blonde woman is a violinist, and the mousy brown-haired woman is the viola player. The man, who is so elderly that he stoops and shuffles, is another violinist. They are all wearing black. They sit in their folding chairs, turn on the lights over their music stands, rattle their sheet music, plink at various strings, and look at each other for consensus. People are suddenly quiet, and into this quiet comes a long, slow, low note that fills the space, that connects to no known piece of music but simply exists, sustains. Alicia is bowing as slowly as it is possible for a human to bow, and the sound she is producing seems to emerge from nowhere, seems to originate between my ears, resonates through my skull like fingers stroking my brain. Then she stops. The silence that follows is brief but absolute. Then all four musicians surge into action. After the simplicity of that single note, their music is dissonant, modern, and jarring, and I think, Bartok? But then I resolve what I'm hearing and realize that they're playing Silent Night. I can't figure out why it sounds so weird until I see the blonde violinist kick Alicia's chair, and after a beat, the piece comes into focus. Claire glances over at me and smiles. Everyone in the church relaxes. Silent Night gives way to a hymn I don't recognize. Everyone stands. They turn toward the back of the church, and the priest walks up the central aisle with a large retinue of small boys and a few men in suits. They solemnly march to the front of the church and take up their positions. The music abruptly stops. Oh, no, I think, what now? Claire takes my hand, and we stand together, in the crowd, and if there is a God, then God, let me just stand here quietly and inconspicuously, here and now. Here and now.
Henry looks as though he's about to pass out. Dear God, please don't let him disappear now. Father Compton is welcoming us in his radio announcer voice. I reach into Henry's coat pocket. Push my fingers through the hole at the bottom, find his cock, and squeeze. He jumps as though I've administered an electric shock. The Lord be with you, says Father Compton. And also with you, we all reply serenely. The same. Everything the same. And yet, here we are, at last, for anyone to see. I can feel Helen's eyes boring into my back. Ruth is sitting five rows behind us with her brother and parents. Nancy, Laura, Mary Christina, Patty, Dave, and Chris, and even Jason Everly. It seems like everyone I went to school with is here tonight. I look over at Henry, who is oblivious to all this. He is sweating. He glances at me, raises one eyebrow. The Mass proceeds. The readings. The Kyrie. Peace be with you, and also with you. We all stand for the Gospel, Luke chapter 2. Everyone in the Roman Empire traveling to their hometowns to be taxed, Joseph and Mary, great with child, the birth, miraculous, humble, the swaddling clothes, the manger. The logic of it has always escaped me, but the beauty of the thing is undeniable. The shepherds abiding in the field, the angel, "Fear not, for behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy."
Henry is jiggling his leg in a very distracting way. He has his eyes closed and he is biting his lip.
Multitudes of angels, Father Compton intones, "But Mary kept all these things and pondered them in her heart."
"Amen," we say, and sit down for the sermon. Henry leans over and whispers, "Where's the restroom?"
"Through that door," I tell him, pointing at the door Alicia and Frank and the others came in through.
"How do I get there?"
"Walk to the back of the church and then down the side aisle."
"If I don't come back..."
"You have to come back."
As Father Compton says, "On this most joyous of nights..." Henry stands and walks quickly away. Father's eyes follow him as he walks back and over and up to the door. I watch as he slips out the door, and it swings shut behind him.
I'm standing in what appears to be the hallway of an elementary school. "Don't panic," I repeat to myself. "No one can see you. Hide somewhere." I look around wildly, and there's a door. Boys. I open it, and I'm in a miniature men's room, brown tile, all the fixtures tiny and low to the ground, radiator blasting, intensifying the smell of institutional soap. I open the window a few inches and stick my face above the crack. There are evergreen trees blocking any view there might have been, and so the cold air I am sucking in tastes of pine. After a few minutes I feel less tenuous. I lie down on the tile, curled up, knees to chin. Here I am, solid. Now, here on this brown tile floor. It seems like such a small thing to ask. Continuity? Surely if there is a God, he wants us to be good, and it would be unreasonable to expect anyone to be good without incentives. And Claire is very, very good, and she even believes in God. And why would he decide to embarrass her in front of all those people? I open my eyes. All the tiny porcelain fixtures have iridescent auras, sky blue and green and purple, and I resign myself to going. There's no stopping now, and I am shaking. No, but I am gone.
Father finishes his sermon, which is about world peace, and Daddy leans across Sharon and Mark and whispers, "Is your friend sick?"
"Yes," I whisper back. "He has a headache, and sometimes they make him nauseous."
"Should I go see if I can help?"
"No, he'll be okay."
Daddy doesn't seem convinced, but he stays in his seat. Father is blessing the host. I try to suppress my urge to run out and find Henry myself. The first pews stand for communion. Alicia is playing Bach's cello suite number 2. It is sad and lovely. Come back, Henry. Come back.
I'm in my apartment in Chicago. It's dark, and I'm on my knees in the living room. I stagger up and whack my elbow on the bookshelves. Fuck! I can't believe this. I can't even get through one day with Claire's family, and I've been sucked up and spit out into my own fucking apartment like a fucking pinball. Hey! I turn, and there I am, sleepily sitting up on the sofa bed. What's the date? I demand. December 28th, 1991. 4 days from now. I sit down on the bed. I can't stand it. Relax. You'll be back in a few minutes. Nobody'll notice. You'll be perfectly okay for the rest of the visit. Yeah? Yeah, stop whining, myself says, imitating Dad perfectly. I want to deck him, but what would be the point? There's music playing softly in the background. Is that Bach? Huh? Oh, yeah. It's in your head. It's Alicia. That's odd. Oh, I run for the bathroom and almost make it.
The last few people are receiving communion when Henry walks in the door, a little pale, but walking. He walks back and up the aisle and squeezes in next to me.
"The Mass is ended. Go in peace," says Father Compton. "Amen," we respond. The altar boys assemble together like a school of fish around Father, and they proceed jauntily up the aisle, and we all file out after them. I hear Sharon ask Henry if he's okay, but I don't catch his reply because Helen and Ruth have intercepted us, and I am introducing Henry. Helen simpers, "But we've met before!" Henry looks at me alarmed. I shake my head at Helen, who smirks. "Well, maybe not," she says. "Nice to meet you, Henry." Ruth shyly offers Henry her hand. To my surprise, he holds it for a moment and then says, "Hello, Ruth," before I have introduced her, but as far as I can tell, she doesn't recognize him. Laura joins us just as Alicia comes up, bumping her cello case through the crowd.
"Come to my house tomorrow," Laura invites. "My parents are leaving for the Bahamas at 4.
We all agree enthusiastically. Every year Laura's parents go someplace tropical the minute all the presents have been opened, and every year we flock over there as soon as their car disappears around the driveway. We part with a chorus of Merry Christmas, and as we emerge through the side door of the church into the parking lot, Alicia says, "Ugh, I knew it." There's deep new snow everywhere. The world has been remade white. I stand still and look at the trees and cars and across the street toward the lake, which is crashing and visible on the beach far below the church on the bluff. Henry stands with me, waiting. Mark says, "Come on, Claire." And I do.
It's about 1:30 in the morning when we walk in the door of Meadowlark House. All the way home, Philip scolded Alicia for her mistake at the beginning of Silent Night, and she sat quietly looking out the window at the dark houses and trees. Now everyone goes upstairs to their rooms after saying Merry Christmas about 50 more times, except Alicia and Claire, who disappear into a room at the end of the first floor hall. I wonder what to do with myself, and on an impulse, I follow them. "A total prick," Alicia is saying as I stick my head in the door. The room is dominated by an enormous pool table, which is bathed in the brilliant glare of the lamp suspended over it. Claire is racking up the balls as Alicia paces back and forth in the shadows at the edge of the pool of light. "Well, if you deliberately try to piss him off and he gets pissed off, I don't see why you're upset," Claire says. "He's just so smug," Alicia says, punching the air with her fists. I cough. They both jump, and then Claire says, "Oh, Henry, thank God, I thought you were Daddy." "You want to play?" Alicia asks me. "No, I'll just watch." There is a tall stool by the table, and I sit on it. Claire hands Alicia a cue. Alicia chalks it, and then breaks sharply. Two stripes fall into corner pockets. Alicia sinks two more before missing, just barely, a combo bank shot. "Uh-oh," says Claire, "I'm in trouble." Claire drops an easy solid, the two ball, which was poised on the edge of a corner pocket. On her next shot, she sends the cue ball into the hole after the three, and Alicia fishes out both balls and lines up her shot. She runs the stripes without further ado. "Eight ball, side pocket," Alicia calls, and that is that. "Ouch," sighs Claire. "Sure you don't want to play?" She offers me her cue. "Come on, Henry," says Alicia. "Hey, do either of you want anything to drink?" "No," says Claire. "What have you got?" I ask. Alicia snaps on a light, and a beautiful old bar appears at the far end of the room. Alicia and I huddle behind it, and lo, there is just about everything I can imagine in the way of alcohol. Alicia mixes herself a rum and coke. I hesitate before such riches, but finally pour myself a stiff whiskey. Claire decides to have something after all, and as she's cracking the miniature tray of ice cubes into a glass for her Kahlua, the door opens and we all freeze. It's Mark. "Where's Sharon?" Claire asks him. "Lock that," commands Alicia. He turns the lock and walks behind the bar. "Sharon's sleeping," he says, pulling a Heineken out of the tiny fridge. He uncaps it and saunters over to the table. "Who's playing?" "Alicia and Henry," says Claire. "Has he been warned?"
Shut up, Mark, Alicia says. She's Jackie Gleason in disguise, Mark assures me. I turn to Alicia. Let the games begin. Claire acts again. Alicia gets the break. The whiskey has coated all my synapses, and everything is sharp and clear. The balls explode like fireworks and blossom into a new pattern. The 13 teeters on the edge of a corner pocket and then falls. Stripes again, Alicia says. She sinks the 15, the 12, and the 9 before a bad leave forces her to try an unmakeable two-rail shot. Claire is standing just at the edge of the light so that her face is in shadow, but her body floats out of the blackness, her arms folded across her chest. I turn my attention to the table. It's been a while. I sink the 2, 3, and 6 easily, and then look for something else to work with. The 1 is smack in front of the corner pocket at the opposite end of the table, and I send the cue ball into the 7, which drops the 1. I send the 4 into a side pocket with a bank shot and get the 5 in the back corner with a lucky carom. It's just slop, but Alicia whistles anyway. The 7 goes down without mishap. 8 in the corner, I indicate with my cue, and in it.